This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. We're going to be talking today about something that we never really talk about here on Mind Talk. And as you listen today, you will be glad that we are talking about it today. I'd like to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Robert Rosenberg, who is the author of Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. So, Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to Mind Talk. I take it your book is about a magic pill.
Hopefully not. It's about sleep. And we try to, by reading the book, we're hoping that people will avoid the magic pill.
Okay, fair enough. Dr. Rosenberg is the medical director of the Sleep Disorder Center of Prescott Valley in Arizona and a sleep medicine consultant for Mountain Heart Health Services in Flagstaff, Arizona. Dr. Rosenberg is board certified in sleep medicine, pulmonary medicine, and internal medicine. Dr. Rosenberg, you are very busy, but it sounds like you know a lot about sleeping, being not so busy.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing for the last 15 years or so, pretty much, in sleep medicine. I find it fascinating.
Well, you know, what's fascinating to me, at least, is that, you know, after all these years of doing a show on relationships and mental health and knowing that sleep has a huge impact on how we think and feel and function, that when I first looked at your book, I thought, well, that's for a medical show. I don't need to do that. And then I began to read and I said, well, wait a minute. What am I talking about? You say early on in the book, you quote someone, you say your life is a reflection of how you sleep, and how you sleep is a reflection of your life. So let's start there. How is sleep a reflection of your life?
Well, sleep is really the cornerstone of health, including psychiatric and psychological health. People who sleep well usually don't suffer from associated anxiety or mood disorders, seem to be less ruminative, basically not great worriers, tend to find it easier to fall and stay asleep than those of us who are more anxious, tend to suffer from depression, anxiety, or just ruminators, people who take their worries into the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a vicious cycle. Obviously, the worse you sleep, the more problems you'll have with the associated mood and anxiety disorders. And the worse they are, the more likely you are to have difficulty sleeping. And what's important is for people to understand that the sleep is very important. And if the sleep is of poor quality and quantity, that may be the reason that they're not responding to that little antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication that their doctor has been giving them.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about the effects that short-term sleep deprivation can result in. Is it all the things you said and then some, or is that essentially it?
Well, we used to think that short-term, meaning let's say a week or two of sleep deprivation, was you could reverse the problems. But there's some recent studies showing out that there may be some irreversible brain damage going on in a part of the brain called the locus coeruleus, which is a part of the brain we need to stay awake and alert. And basically, it was very surprising. This study was done in mice, but when mice were exposed for short periods of time to similar work hours as shift workers and deprived of sleep, when biopsied, they found that there was actually a 25% loss of neurons in that area of the brain, which I thought was stunning, because really we didn't think that short-term sleep could do that. We know that long-term sleep deprivation certainly can have adverse outcomes on parts of the brain, especially the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex, which is pretty much where a lot of our emotions are produced and regulated.
Well, you define short-term sleep deprivation as a week. What's the definition of long-term deprivation?
Well, we consider anybody who has ongoing problems with sleep, both difficulty falling and staying asleep, as after a month, we usually define that as chronic insomnia.
Okay.
So that would, and then of course you have people who are burning the candle at both ends,
right,
and are getting by on 6 hours of sleep a night. And the National Sleep Foundation says 33% of the population is, and these people are living on 6 hours of sleep or less chronically. I mean, and they try to function on that, and in many cases they keep doing it. There's even a name for it now. It's called behaviorally induced insufficient sleep syndrome.
Interesting. We've got a label for everything, don't we?
We have to.
You have to have a way of thinking about things, so you know
right,
how
you
to
have
begin
to. Have an
to
acronym or
that's
something
right.
So
that's
you can
right.
Remember these things.
All right, behaviorally induced. All right. So,
yeah.
And that's if you're doing this chronically. Are we defining? We're defining that as a month or more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and these people usually pay a consequence, but they're the ones who are, you know, staying up till 1 o'clock in the morning, getting up early, you know, the burning the candle at both ends. It's very common, and it's leading to obesity and hypertension and cardiovascular death prematurely in a significant portion of the population.
Now, when we talk about the number of hours that are recommended for an adult to sleep, what is the current recommendation?
Between 7 and 9.
Okay.
Some would say 7 to 8.5, but that seems to be the area of health when people are sleeping less than 6 or 7 hours, certainly less than 6. We start to see a lot of emotional and physical problems begin to develop. And when people sleep more than 9 hours, there's some studies showing that that may predispose to certain physical problems. One recent study showed a stiffening of the blood vessels, of the arteries, in people who slept consistently more than 9 hours.
Okay.
I think the data on the long sleepers is not as solid as the data on the short sleepers, but we're learning that even long sleepers may have problems with their health as a result of sleeping too long.
And too long is 9 hours or more for...
More than 9 hours.
More than nine hours for a day, a week?
Chronically. Most of this is...
Chronically.
These are chronic sleep patterns. Most
okay.
of these people have been followed over 12 to 15 years
gotcha.
In epidemiological studies.
Now, there are different kinds of insomnia, so let's go through the different kinds. Before we do that, though, I just want to go back, and because I want to remind folks that the sleep issue that we're talking about has a tremendous impact on emotional relationship health and well-being, mental health and well-being. So again, short-term deprivation can result in at least decreased concentration, irritability, bad mood, tremors, hallucinations, and diminished immune function. Is that accurate?
That's correct. We do see that even if you've gone through a week or two of sleep deprivation and you get a flu shot, your antibody response is going to be much lower than if you had slept at least 7 hours a night prior to getting that influenza vaccination. So we same thing with hepatitis vaccinations. And we're also seeing the production in the body of people who sleep for short periods of time of what we call inflammatory mediators, which inhibit the immune system and can predispose people to infections.
So this notion that if you don't get enough sleep tonight, you can make it up over the weekend. Lots of people say that.
Right.
That's not true.
Not true. And there are several studies recently that state that no, it doesn't work. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's not a lot better than nothing. There's irreversible damage being done, and the recovery in terms of certain facets of mood does not really occur after the weekend of longer sleep. And the longer sleep on the weekend tends to throw your circadian cycle off so that it's very difficult to get to a normal sleep-wake cycle come Monday and Tuesday.
And explain what the circadian cycle is. What does that mean?
We have clock genes in our brain, basically, in the hypothalamus. And normally we start, these clock genes really control our sleep-wake schedule. It's a 24-hour clock. And they at about 9 o'clock at night, and most people, that part of the hypothalamus sends out a signal to start to get ready to go to sleep. Melatonin is produced, and our body temperature begins to drop. And that's a signal to fall asleep. And so, and most people, they get groggy by 10, 10:30, and they're asleep. And they wake up at 6, 6:30 in the morning. However, that circadian cycle can be thrown off behaviorally, and then because you stayed up to 2 or 3 in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning all summer long, if you're a kid or if you're an adult,
right,
on the weekends or on vacations, and then come work time, you're trying to get back to work, that circadian clock isn't suddenly going to go right back to where you want it to be or where it was before, and it can become a source of not only problems but of chronic insomnia. A lot of my patients with insomnia actually have a circadian disorder where they produce melatonin at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and they've been doing that since they were adolescents, and that is why they're unable to fall asleep before 1 or 2, yet they have to get up for work at 6.
Right. The difference between primary insomnia and chronic insomnia is what?
Well, primary insomnia and chronic insomnia can be one and the same.
Okay.
The difference between primary insomnia is that there are no predisposing factors. In other words, there is no significant mood disorder. There is no significant anxiety disorder. There is no significant medical disorder like heart failure or respiratory problems that cause you to have chronic sleep problems. For instance, low oxygen at night wakes a lot of people up with lung and heart disease, and they don't know that. They don't realize that's the reason they can't stay asleep. We put them on oxygen, and they sleep like babies. So that would be a secondary. Now, the primary insomnia person would be somebody who has, you've looked at all of that as a sleep physician. I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
And we found no predisposing, no comorbid illness of any significance.
I see.
They just have primary insomnia, meaning they have developed negative sleep-promoting behaviors when they get into the bedroom. They become anxious. They turn the TV on. They do a lot of things. They drink too much caffeine to keep them awake. And those are what we call primary or psychophysiological insomnia.
Okay. And you have discussed briefly in your book that there are really two schools of thought about why people suffer from insomnia, one being
yes.
hyperarousal theory, the other one being anxiety-prone personalities. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, I can. There's a lot of good work coming out of Penn State University. It's called the Penn State Cohort Group. And they're finding, they actually have a survey or a study going on all the people in that area of Pennsylvania around the university. It's about 20,000 people.
Wow.
And they're finding there are some people who are insomniacs and short sleepers who produce too much cortisol, more adrenaline. They're what we call hypothalamic or hyperpituitary adrenal axis is overcharged. And so that is probably the cause of the insomnia. When you're producing a lot of cortisol at night and you're producing a lot of adrenaline, two hormones which normally aren't produced at all to speak of it during the nighttime, you're going to have a hard time falling and staying asleep.
Okay.
Then there's a second group of people who are ruminators. It's more of a psychological problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They tend to be worriers, and they tend to be the other group of people who have insomnia. And we believe the basis for their insomnia is more psychological, more anxiety-prone, their personalities. And so that's how we divide the two. And it's helpful in terms of as being a sleep specialist. When people come to me, if I can weed that out, it helps me to determine what kind of therapy will work for them.
Right. That makes sense. All right. Dr. Robert Rosenberg, author of Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but when we come back, we're going to continue with this. And I would highly recommend that whatever you're doing, you sit still, you pay attention, you take notes. And his book is, I think, a really important read. We're going to take a break. As I said, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Hi, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk. We continue our conversation with Dr. Robert Rosenberg, who has written A Guide to Solving Your Sleep Problems. And from the beginning of our conversation, I'm thinking there are a lot of people who listen who are having sleep problems. Dr. Rosenberg, is there a gender impact on sleep difficulties? Are men or women more or less likely, or does gender matter?
Well, gender matters when it comes to sleep apnea. Men are much more likely to have sleep apnea until women go through the menopause. And sleep apnea is a major health problem in the United States. 18 million Americans suffer from it. And when it comes to insomnia, it appears women are more likely. There's a lot of theories as to why. One is hormonal changes and menopause and the associated sleep issues. The other is that women are much more likely in most surveys to talk to their physician or psychologist or whoever about their sleep issues than men. A lot of men still have the John Wayne syndrome, I mean, where they just, you know, they don't. When I go to the doctor, they're not going to talk to him about or her about their sleep.
Right.
And so that may be one of the reasons we see women reporting insomnia much more commonly in surveys. And in my practice, I see both, but I certainly see more women with insomnia than I do men. And women tend to predominate when it comes to restless leg syndrome. It's about a 2-to-1 ratio, which is a real medical problem as well when it comes to sleep. So there's another area where women, the sexual preference, not sexual preference, but sexuality has something to do with the disorder.
Well, let's get some definitions for the two things that you've discussed just now, sleep apnea and restless leg. Sleep apnea is what?
Sleep apnea is where you stop breathing in your sleep. Your airway actually collapses. It's the soft tissue part of the airway we call the pharynx. That goes from the back of your nose all the way down to the beginning of your vocal cords, and that's soft. There's no cartilage and there's no bone. And if it's smaller than normal because of you're being overweight or because of in women when they lose estrogen it becomes more collapsible. Mm-hmm. When we go to sleep, we lose the higher brain centers. When we're awake, obviously our airway won't collapse, so people would be falling all over the ground in the United States. But when they go to sleep, you're working on the brainstem, reflexes, and the airway in some people will collapse. And it'll collapse for 30 or 40 seconds or longer. And when that occurs, your oxygen levels drop, your carbon dioxide levels go up, your blood pressure goes way up in your sleep, and the incidence of heart attack and stroke and cardiac arrhythmias and other problems and mood disorders associated with the continual closure of the airway has great consequences on the ability of people to function, and that's called obstructive sleep apnea. Some people have a form of sleep apnea called central, where the brain fails to send a signal to the respiratory system to breathe. They make no effort to breathe, and that's more commonly seen in people who have heart conditions or have had strokes.
Okay.
So those are your two major forms of sleep apnea, and they are very common in the United States.
And from what you're saying, you know, the fact that they're very common is very scary because you can die.
Oh, yeah.
Do people realize?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do you think so many people will say, I have sleep apnea, she's got sleep apnea. Do you think that they have taken in full measure the seriousness of that kind of diagnosis?
No, not some who have read up on it have. A lot of my patients are dragged in by their wife or their girlfriend or their boyfriend because they snore and they've seen them stop breathing. Or their cardiologist or their neurologist has urged them to see me because they've had a stroke or they're about to, or their blood pressure is uncontrollable and they told the doctor they snore. And so that usually we sit down with them and we then begin to explain to them how critical it is to diagnose and treat this disorder, and that the incidence of recurrent heart attack, if you've already had one, or recurrent stroke, if you've already had one and we don't treat it, is extremely high, and there's no way around it, you know, that you really do need to treat the disorder. So for a lot of folks, it's an eye-opener. I frequently give people materials to read on so that they have a better understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we teach them, once you educate them, that's when we get good compliance with the various treatments.
Okay.
A lot of people come to me who have been placed on some form of therapy for sleep apnea and aren't using it because they tell me, you know, no one ever really sat down and talked to me about it.
Yeah. All right. So sleep apnea, a critically serious issue that one should absolutely pay attention to and take care of.
Absolutely.
And restless leg, what is that?
Restless leg is the usually occurs after dark. I mean, that's one of the things usually at night. Usually when you're not moving, when you're still, you're sitting or you get into bed, people get an irresistible urge to move their legs, frequently in response to some kind of a weird feeling. It could be pain, it could be tightness, it could be tingling. Some cases, people really just have the urge to move their legs and they can't give me a description of what it is they feel. And they find that they get temporarily relief of the feeling when they move them. So they'll either move their legs in bed constantly, get up and march around the room, walk around the house. I mean, that's what goes on. And that's basically what restless leg is. And it's a leading cause of sleep disturbances in the United States.
Okay.
About 10% of people have it, about 2-to-1 women to men. High family incidence. So if your mother or father had it, there's a 30% chance you're going to have it. And a lot of people ignore it. I mean, I don't know how many people come to me with either an inability to fall or remain asleep. They've seen countless primary care doctors, but no one's ever asked them about their restless legs. And when we do and we treat it, it's in some cases their sleep problem evaporates.
Interesting. And again, I think it cannot be repeated enough that when you are sleeping in a healthy fashion or you have achieved an accurate diagnosis and treatment for whatever the sleep difficulty is, not only does that issue get addressed, but your mood can change, your irritability can change, focus and concentration can improve. So there is so much that is tied to how you sleep, how often you sleep, how long you sleep, and the quality of your sleep.
True. Remarkable how important sleep is. And when we do treat these sleep disorders, how we can see improvement in moods, we can see improvements in cognition. In kids with ADHD, frequently they're misdiagnosed as ADHD and they really have a sleep disorder. And once we treat the sleep disorder, in one study, 50% of kids who had ADHD and sleep apnea, when the sleep apnea was treated, 50% of them a year later were off of Ritalin and other drugs for ADHD. In other words, they no longer had the diagnosis of ADHD.
That's fascinating. On so many levels.
You
talk about different kinds of behaviors that some people experience going through as they're experiencing sleep difficulties. So let's kind of go through them. I think many folks have heard of, but perhaps a couple not so much. Sleepwalking, for example, is that typical male, female?
Well, sleepwalking is common in children. We know maybe 30% of children at one time or another report, the parents report they're sleepwalking at least once, maybe in 7 or 8% chronically. But in adults, surprisingly, about 2% of adults either continue to sleepwalk or begin sleepwalking as adults. And adult sleepwalking can be more dangerous than childhood sleepwalking. They're more prone, although not commonly, but more prone to violent events, which, again, is not usual but can happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to do things like, drive the car or go through a window or whatever. And it's more problematic for the bed partner than with a child that you can easily guide back to bed. So sleepwalking is not uncommon. A lot of people, I don't know how many patients come to me, and in the course of our discussions about another sleep disorder, they tell me they sleepwalk. And we find that sleepwalking could be promoted in adults or caused by medications such as Ambien or the antipsychotics or lithium. And also sleep apnea and restless leg syndrome are very common causes of sleepwalking. And when treated, adults stop sleepwalking.
Now, you know, I was about to ask you, and then you answered it for me, if you get through childhood without having a sleepwalking issue, are you assured that in adulthood it will not surface? But that's not true.
No, not true. We do find adults whose sleepwalking began during adulthood. And that's usually a clue for me to look into a primary sleep disorder that might have triggered it.
I see.
It's much more common that there'll be an underlying sleep disorder or medication that they're taking that is causing the sleepwalking than if they were sleepwalkers as children.
And I heard you say a moment ago that people can drive while they're asleep?
Yeah, we've had reports certainly on Ambien of sleep driving. I think it made the press 2 or 3 years ago. There was some study done of 5 or 6 people So yes, it can. It's not common, but it can happen. And I've had patients who've been brought to me because they drove the car or went into a tree or whatever, and they were asleep driving.
So they
basically,
they literally, I was going to say woke up. They literally did not wake up, got out
no,
of bed,
they did not.
Walked to wherever their car was, got the key, started, did the whole thing.
Right.
Went out into the street, and they're asleep.
Yes, they are in a sleep. If we were to put electroencephalogram on them, we'd probably find they're coming in and out of delta or slow wave or what is the deepest form, deepest period of sleep. And yes, that seems to be what's going on when we get a chance to study them in lab, and we occasionally catch an episode of sleepwalking. And that's usually the case. I know it's hard for people to understand it,
yeah.
But the higher cortical centers are really not functioning, and certainly the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain which inhibits weird behaviors and is kind of your super ego, so to speak, that's gone in sleep. And so they have motor, what we call central pattern generators. I don't want to get too complicated, but in the brainstem, that are capable of motor activity, and that's what's going on. Those areas in the deep down in the brainstem, primitive areas of the brain, they're working while the rest of the brain is basically asleep and not able to tell them, hey, this is the wrong thing to be doing.
That really is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is.
And scary. And you also talk about other things that people might do in their sleep. Sex
right.
in the sleep?
Yes.
Talk
sex
about
insomnia
that.
Can be a manifestation of sleepwalking or similar sleepwalking. It can also be a manifestation of REM behavior disorder, where some people actually can move and act out their dreams. And in sexsomnia, we see anything from masturbation to mounting to sexual intercourse. And in some cases, they become forensic cases because someone has been accused of molesting somebody, and it ends up in a court. I've actually been able to, actually have been asked in one case to testify at a case involving that. So yeah, it's serious. It's not common, but it's not as uncommon. And I urge people, if they have the problem, to talk to somebody, their healthcare worker, get a referral to someone, maybe a sleep specialist, because it is diagnosable, it is treatable, and a lot of people are just embarrassed and they don't want to talk about it.
Well, yeah, I can see being embarrassed and not wanting to talk about it, but I can also see maybe talking about it and people looking at them as though they've lost their minds. I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, you need to talk to the right person. I mean, yeah, exactly. If you come to me or a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist who has some familiarity with it, certainly. And if you talk to your friend Joe on the golf course, you know, he might look at you like, you know, there's too much information.
Or yeah, right. You know, why don't you make up a more believable story because that one's not working.
Right, right. And it's for real. I've had enough patients over the years who've had the problem, and frequently it is, well, it's usually rectifiable one way or the other, either by treating the underlying sleep disorder that promotes it, or there is one or two medications that will stop, in most cases, stop the behavior.
Okay. What I worry about, certainly with sexsomnia and with anything that you're doing while you're asleep, but certainly sexsomnia and driving while you're asleep, or even cooking while you're asleep, which you've talked about,
right.
I worry about how that gets used in a criminal action where somebody says, I'm not guilty on account of I didn't know what I was doing. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back, and I'd like to pick up right there. All right?
Okay.
Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Dr. Robert S. Rosenberg, an expert in sleep. He has written a book, Sleep Soundly, Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. We'll be right back with more. Hello again, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer listening to Mind Talk, and let's continue this really interesting conversation about sleep and its impact on your emotional and mental health. Dr. Rosenberg, just before the break, I raised my concern about people using these various sleep disorders in criminal proceedings. How easy is it to say, it's not my fault? You know, someone says that they've been raped by someone. It's not my fault I was asleep. How easy is that?
Easy. There are some guidelines in terms of cases. If someone's going to claim that they have sexsomnia, usually we'd like one proof of either sleepwalking or sexual activities that arose out of sleep in the past.
Okay.
That's very important. Number two, they make no effort to cover it up at the time. They usually, when they're awoken and it's happened, they're astonished, they're shocked, they're freaked out. When you have somebody who tries to cover it up, that usually doesn't fly. So there are
okay.
The main thing though is usually a history of sleepwalking or of the behavior in the past. In the case I was involved in, the gentleman who was accused of the act witnesses came forward who said that over the years, you know, he had tried to have sexual behavior activity with them during sleep. He was obviously asleep, and that it was nothing new. And that was basically what the defense used to try to prove that it was not malingering, that he wasn't making it up, that there was really a history of it.
I'm curious. Can you tell us how that trial turned out?
Actually, in that case, he was found innocent.
Wow. That's really interesting. And earlier, before the break, I talked about cooking while asleep. Was I accurate? Does that happen?
Yes. There is sleep-related eating disorder, which is not uncommon, probably more common than sexsomnia, where people literally go to the kitchen. They'll ingest really toxic substances. But they also tend to eat a lot of sweets and sugars, and the refrigerator will be found open or the burners are left on at night because they've been cooking. They have no memory. It's not uncommon on, again, the same drugs I mentioned with sleepwalking, with Ambien, with some of the antipsychotics, the newer atypical antipsychotics. But it's also not uncommon in people who have underlying sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome. The sleep disordered breathing or the restless legs, kind of partially wakes them up. This is what we think from sleep, but not totally.
Mm-hmm.
Leaves them in that no man's land between sleep and wakefulness. And that's really what sleepwalking and these disorders are. You're stuck somewhere in between sleep and wakefulness. And yeah, it's not uncommon at all to find out that people have what's called sleep-related eating disorder. I mean, they'll get back into bed on their own, wake up in the morning, and then find out the kitchen is strewn with all kinds of items. They have no memory of taking them out or leaving the burners on.
So it's not only scary to the individual, but it's scary to the household, potentially.
Oh, yeah. I've had many a husband or wife who brings them in because they're worried they're going to burn the place down or they're going to hurt themselves. They don't, you know, the husband or the wife doesn't even wake up, and they're afraid what they're going to eat, what they're going to ingest, what they're going to do.
It really is astounding. Let's break away from the definitions for a moment and go through some of the signs that you might want to go in and meet with your doctor about the possibility of a sleep disorder. Early on in the book, you have a checklist,
right.
Sleep disorder checklist. Can you just give us some of the behaviors that are indicated in this checklist?
Right. I mean, if you're waking up in the morning and you're sleepy and fatigued and you have significant sleep inertia, you might want to look into the possibility that you might have a sleep disorder that is causing that. Okay, that would be one thing. Obviously, if you're finding things in the kitchen like we just talked about, or
right.
people are discussing with you the possibility of that that you might be eating in your sleep or doing anything like that, you probably want to look and see if there's a sleep disorder that's responsible for that. If you're having trouble concentrating at work,
mm-hmm.
brain fog, fatigue all the time, it might well be a sleep disorder that is the cause of that. So those are other reasons. If you suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and you have frequent nightmares, or let's say if you have frequent nightmares, you might want to look into the possibility maybe it's related to a traumatic event that
uh-huh.
occurred at one time in your life, and that's important. It's so important in PTSD to treat the sleep disorder. Otherwise, you don't get good results in terms of the PTSD. If you wake up with morning headaches or you're frequently urinating at night, so many of my patients with sleep apnea come to me with that symptom, not realizing that it was the sleep apnea and the low oxygen that caused the frequent urination and the morning headaches that they've been suffering with for years.
Interesting. And if you have been depressed for a long time and the medications don't work, take a look at your sleep?
Absolutely. We find that that in people with sleep disorders, that recalcitrance or refractoriness to antidepressants is very common. Because if you look at the symptoms of sleep deprivation, especially when it's associated with sleep apnea, moodiness, irritability, fatigue, all the things you would use you as a psychotherapist in your checklist when you're checking off depression, at least 90% of them have in common sleep disorders. And sleep disorders would present with very similar symptoms to depression.
At least 90%.
Right. I mean, fatigue, loss of interest in doing things, anhedonia, you know, all the symptoms that we look for in depression, very commonly we find in sleep disorders. So it's not surprising that when you have a sleep disorder along with the depression, that you might not be responding to the antidepressants or to the psychotherapy, because no one has ever thought to ask about a sleep disorder, which might be the driving engine that's really hanging you up in terms of getting the results you want to get out of that emotional morass.
So for the clinicians who listen, and I know we have a number of clinicians who listen to the program, it would behoove all of us to include something of a sleep disorder checklist in our initial work, just to make sure that we don't need to refer someone to a person like you.
Absolutely. I don't know how many of my patients come to me and no one's ever asked them about their legs or about their sleep at all. You know, how do you sleep? That simple opening conversation, how do you sleep? And it's amazing. If you just include that in your history, you'll get so much information. And it opens up a world of possibilities to what's going on with the patient, because the sleep and the medical problems, as well as the psychiatric problems, are so interlinked. For instance, people with fibromyalgia, they sleep very poorly. They also have a very high incidence of restless leg and sleep apnea, very high. We don't know why, but they do. And when we treat those sleep disorders, their fibromyalgia responds much better than it ever has before.
Interesting. Is there a particular kind of checklist that you would recommend clinicians use?
There's the Pittsburgh. If you go online, there's the Pittsburgh Sleep Questionnaire is excellent.
Okay.
If you want to buy my book, you know, that's excellent too. But the Pittsburgh Sleep Questionnaire is a very good, thorough sleep questionnaire. Therefore, you know, when my patients come to me, I spend a lot of time with them. But in what I have them fill out, I have them fill out a Beck Depression Inventory, an anxiety scale. Mm-hmm. All of these things are on my desk before you walk into the room. I've already gone over them, and I have a pretty good idea of what's going on before the patient even walks in. If you have some type of a sleep checklist, or if it's sleep apnea, what we call a stop-bang sleep questionnaire or the Berlin sleep questionnaire. You can get these online. They take 2 minutes for the patient to fill out and takes no time for you to score it, and it will be very revealing in terms of sleep disorders.
And, of course, as you mentioned, there's this book written by this guy named Robert Rosenberg called Sleep Soundly Every Night. You might want to pick up a copy of that, too. I think you would agree with that.
Yes. I think the book is for the late person, but I think the primary care and, you know, people in psychiatry can learn something from this, because most of us, we never learned anything in medical school about sleep. We didn't learn about REM behavior disorder. We know very little about sleepwalking, and we know very little about most of the sleep disorders that I talk about in the book. And it's very important that we self-educate and make up for the deficit we did not get during our training.
Absolutely. Let's go back to children and ADD or ADHD, as we're back to referring to it these days. You're saying that many children who have been diagnosed with ADHD, in fact, have an underlying sleep issue. And with the underlying sleep issue resolved, the ADHD symptoms are resolved as well. They're not there.
In some, in many. Well, in the sleep apnea case, that study was done, and that was a 50% resolution in those children who had sleep apnea and ADHD. But we find about 20-25% of children with ADHD have restless leg syndrome. Now, that does not mean that by treating the restless leg syndrome, you're going to get rid of the ADHD in all of them. But yes, exactly. in a significant proportion of those who have it, you will. Because think about it. Restless leg in children especially, have a hard time explaining it, but it causes them to want to move around. And in kids, it seems to go on during the day more often than it does in adults. So they can't sit still in class. They can't concentrate. Their sleep has been disturbed all night by their legs, and therefore they present with an inability to control impulses, inability to concentrate, to pay attention. Guess what? That's the definition of ADHD for most people.
It certainly is. It certainly is. That's the first place you go with that kind of behavior.
Right. So look for a sleep disorder in these children, because that may actually be, and those are the same symptoms that children with sleep apnea. Adults with sleep apnea tend to present sleepy. Children with sleep apnea tend to be hyperactive and can't sit still. That's been the story with sleep apnea for at least 15 years. We've known that pediatric sleep apnea presents in a very different way than adult sleep apnea. And once up to primary care psychiatrists, psychologists understand that, then they're more likely to question the parents and the child about sleep issues. And a lot of children with ADHD don't get enough sleep. They tend to be very restless sleepers.
Right.
They should be getting, let's say, 10 or 11 hours of sleep at the age of 6 or 7, and they're only getting 7 or 8. In some cases, it's because the parents think 7 or 8 is normal.
Right.
And if you have a child who's getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep who's 6 or 7 years old, they're going to present with many of the symptoms of ADHD.
Huh. So let's take a moment and sort of veer off from, let's say, infancy to maybe 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's a reasonable amount of sleep for a child?
Well, infancy is about 14 to 16 hours a day. Okay. And then in toddlers, we're looking at 11 to 12 hours a day, for sure.
Okay.
Actually, maybe, and some would say 12 to 13. And then in preschool, 3 to 5, it should be about 11 hours, sometimes 12. So a lot of parents don't realize how much sleep their children are supposed to get.
Right.
And as a result, they don't realize that a lot of the behaviors, the irritability, the trouble focusing and concentrating.
Absolutely.
The kids cannot keep the same schedule that mom and dad keep.
Right. And if mom and dad keep lousy schedules, it's almost a natural that the children will learn to do that as well.
Sure. A recent study came out, National Sleep Foundation, that parents who had electronics in their bedrooms, televisions in their bedrooms, and all of that, children found them to be poor models. And as a result, the children tended to do the same thing. And the parents did not interfere because the parents don't realize how badly or negatively those electronics affect children's sleep.
So I'm thinking about all these teenagers who go to sleep, stay asleep, wake up, you know, and they have their cell phones attached to their hips or actually
right.
their ears. And parents will say any number of things, but they won't remove the phone from the child. Should they remove that phone from the child?
Yes, they should, especially if your child is exhibiting signs of insufficient sleep, moodiness, irritability, depression, suicidality, trouble in school, concentrating, focusing. Yeah, those electronic devices in the bedroom, especially the cell phone, which gives off intense blue light, and also is ringing and they're listening to it and through all hours, is possibly one of the major causes. As a matter of fact, there was a recent study in Australia that showed that in teenagers in high school, one out of five, their poor sleep and their insufficient sleep was related to electronic devices in the bedroom.
One out of five.
That was the other who were getting definitely insufficient sleep and had symptoms as a result. That 20% of them, it could be traced to electronics in the bedroom.
While the parents who are listening are gulping with that piece of information, we're going to take a break, and we will be right back to continue our conversation with Dr. Robert Rosenberg. My name is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Hello again, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, continuing the conversation with Dr. Rosenberg, author of Sleep Soundly Every Night, A Doctor's Guide to Solving Your Sleep Problems. Dr. Rosenberg, throughout our conversation, we've essentially been talking about people who can make a choice to change their sleep habits. What about those who do not believe they can make a choice? What about shift workers? What do they do?
Well, if about 10 or 15% of people suffer from shift workers disorder, which means that they either cannot fall asleep during the daytime when they come back from work, or they can't stay awake on the job when they're at work. There are things they can do to help improve their ability to fall asleep and stay awake. One thing is, for a shift worker, when you're coming home from work and you want to go to bed and it's bright outside, wear dark sunglasses. As a matter of fact, I recommend they get blue blocker glasses, and they're available on various websites. They're the best in terms of blocking out parts of the sun spectrum, the light spectrum that will keep you awake.
Okay.
When you get home, people need to understand things need to be quiet and dark. You can't have the kids running around, or if they are, they have to be in another part of the house. And you might want to try a little bit of melatonin, as long as your doctor says it's okay. I have found that certainly for shift workers, taking a very low dose of melatonin when they get home helps them to get into a more natural sleep. So, before you go to work, if you want to take a 45-minute nap about an hour or two before work, that can help you get through the work more alert state. And also bright lights for the first 3 to 4 hours at work is very important. So there are things shift workers can do. And in some cases, though, it's such a problem and the health deteriorates so badly that it's not unusual for me to write a letter to their employer trying to get them off the shift work and back to day work, because there are just some people who, no matter what we do, we can't get them to be able to sleep normally and function normally during shift work. And it deteriorates their health. There's very high incidence of diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, and cancer in shift workers. And we think that probably is due to the circadian abnormality of the shift work itself and the lack of sleep.
Cancer. That's interesting. I didn't expect to hear you say cancer.
Yeah, Pamela, the nurses' Health Foundation, there was a long study that went on for years, Nurses' Sleep Health Foundation study. They found that there was a very high incidence of breast cancer in nurses who were shift workers. And we've since then found that the incidence of cancer in people with sleep apnea and other sleep disorders is much higher than would be expected.
Huh.
And we believe it's due to the oxygen levels going up and down, and they cause what's called neovascularization, or new blood vessels to form around cancer cells and feed them, where normally they would have been killed immediately by the body's immune system.
Hmm. For those people who can be up and awake and theoretically engaged, but they fall asleep when they're not actively involved in something, is that potentially a function of a sleep disorder?
Yes, that would be. If you're someone who when you're not actively engaged in things, tends to fall asleep at the movies, fall asleep watching the television, fall asleep at lunchtime, after lunch, you just cannot keep awake, or you're always falling asleep, that is usually a signal you might have a primary sleep disorder. It could be narcolepsy. It could be one of the disorders similar to narcolepsy, such as what we call idiopathic hypersomnolence syndrome, where the brain is just not producing enough wake-promoting chemicals or neurotransmitters. Or it could be a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea or restless leg, or low oxygen at night that is causing you to constantly awake from sleep, but not long enough to remember it. Most people with sleep apnea we see will wake up 30, 40, sometimes 50 times an hour in the laboratory in response to not breathing, yet they have no memory of this ever occurring because it's so short that the brain does not absorb it and does not process it.
You mentioned narcolepsy. For those who don't know what that is, can you give us a description?
Sure. Narcolepsy is a disorder of the brain where the hypothalamus doesn't produce enough of the major wake-promoting chemical or hormone called hypocretin. In any event, it's an autoimmune disease. It usually begins in the second or third decade. There's actually destruction of the neurons that produce this wake-promoting chemical or neurotransmitter. And then, so it's accompanied initially by severe sleepiness. They begin to have difficulty staying awake. They may have sleep attacks, fall asleep in the middle of a conversation, have trouble driving. Then we start to see in about 75% of them cataplexy, where if they get emotional, if they get angry, if they laugh, especially laughter, they tend to get weak. Their head may droop forward, their arms may sag, they may fall to the ground because their leg muscles give out. And basically, it's the intrusion of REM sleep into wakefulness. And during REM, we become paralyzed. And that's called cataplexy. And they'll also have episodes of sleep paralysis where upon awakening in the morning, they're wide awake and they can't move their body for a minute or two. And they find that to be very frightening. And they also have what's called hallucinations upon awakening or sleeping, where they actually see things, they know it's not there, but they see and hear things. But the major symptom of narcolepsy is sleepiness, and the second big one is the cataplexy, where when they become emotional, they get weak and have trouble standing or keeping their head up, or their eyes may droop. And they look as if they're unconscious, but yet they're wide awake when this is occurring, even though they're sitting there facing you with your eyes closed, they just can't move.
You know, there are so many things that we've talked about during this hour that could, quite frankly, scare somebody into, not doing anything, because a lot of times that's what we do. Having a sleep disorder, is it relatively easy to address? Is it okay to ignore it? What are some of the first steps people should take?
Okay. First of all, it's relatively easy to address if you go to the right people. That your healthcare worker, your healthcare professional, or whoever it might be. If it's a complicated sleep problem and they refer you to a sleep specialist, then that's probably the way to go. Disorders like sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, and narcolepsy are all very treatable. How do I know? Because I have hundreds of patients with those disorders and they're doing just fine.
Okay.
If you don't treat them, on the other hand, if you ignore them, you're probably going to have a problem. Certainly the sleep apnea is probably going to lead to high blood pressure and an early heart attack or stroke, which we don't want. That'll ruin your whole day.
Right.
And the narcolepsy, the problem with narcolepsy, by the way, is that most studies show the diagnosis is delayed in most people by 15 years. It was missed. No one ever thought of it.
Wow.
And early diagnosis of narcolepsy is so important, because with medications, we can treat narcolepsy, and they do very well. They'll be awake, the sleep disorders vanish. It's not that difficult a disorder to treat. I know there are those out there who will say, well, that's not the case. But really, in the majority of my patients with narcolepsy, they're not going to be 100%,
okay,
but if we can get them to 80 or 90%, and that's pretty good compared to where they were.
Right. Now, you talk about treatment, you talk about medication, and then, of course, earlier you were talking about one medication in particular that's pretty horrifying for people with, actually may produce some of the symptoms that look like sleep disorders. So when you talk about treatment of a sleep disorder, what are the treatments that people might look forward to being recommended? Is it always medication, or is it never?
No.
Okay.
No, you're right. You're right. That's a great question. No, for insomnia, if you go to your doctor or your mid-level, whoever, and you say, I'm having trouble sleeping, and the first thing to do is write you a prescription for a sleep aid, and they don't take a history, I would say that you very politely get up and walk out. Okay, I mean, that's not what should be done. We need to take a thorough history, and then we need to consider cognitive behavioral therapy. So there are some excellent behavioral treatments for insomnia that can reverse the problem with good sleep hygiene without having to take medication. So in most areas of sleep medicine, we don't use medication.
Okay.
There are some areas where we have to. In narcolepsy, we do. Sleep apnea does not require medication. There isn't any medication for it. You need to wear a device or get an oral appliance that keeps you really open. But getting back to insomnia, which is the most common sleep disorder, the cognitive behavioral therapy done in the hands of somebody who knows how to use it, in many cases, can get rid of the insomnia. We need to teach restructuring of your thoughts, looking at your sleep differently, not catastrophizing,
right,
getting out of bad sleep habits, get rid of the caffeine, don't eat the crazy junk food before bedtime, which is contributing to it. So there are sometimes simple things that will turn people's sleep around just because no one ever thought to speak to them about it.
Dr. Rosenberg, the hour has just flown by. This really has been a fascinating conversation for me. I've learned a few things, so I'm always appreciative of that. And I also have to say that the book is written in a way that it's very readable. And it's tailored in such a way that you understand why you're reading this part and now you're going on to this part. So thank you for that. Sleep soundly every night. Feel fantastic every day. Dr. Robert S. Rosenberg, I absolutely recommend that all of us take a look at this book. It's clinicians and non-clinicians alike. I think you will find it very useful and in many ways change your lives, change your viewpoints. Folks, again, thank you to Dr. Rosenberg. Dr. Rosenberg, you have a blog, and can you give us that address?
Yeah, to everydayhealth.com, I write for them, but at answersforsleep.com, that's my own website, and we try to get people's questions answered within 3 to 4 days about sleep, and we have a ton of information about all the sleep disorders we've talked about and some we haven't talked about are on the website if you care to go to it, answersforsleep.com.
Okay, and the other organization that you write for?
Everydayhealth.com is kind of like a WebMD. They're one of the internet health related issues. I write a weekly column on sleep for them and have been for about a year and a half now.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Rosenberg, for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and I want to thank you for listening today as we had our conversation. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. Special thanks to promotion assistance provided by Courtney Ebu and by LaDonna Smith. Mind Talk is produced as a entertaining and educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And for more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You'll find commentary and shows you can listen to and re-listen to. There's lots to do at mindtalk.org. And folks, please remember, always remember, if it's unacceptable, you know the rest. It's unacceptable. Take care.